Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Safe, and we're still a little bit hungover, not by the election results from earlier this week so much as by the spin and all of the counter narratives. So we've asked our publisher, Bulwark publisher, Sarah Longwell, to come in to sort all of this out. Thanks for coming in, Sarah. Appreciate it very much.
Hey, Charlie. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm looking at Tim Miller's piece that was up in on the Bulwark when, you know, Republicans get crushed at the polls and talk radio guys say hug Trump tighter. I talked about this with Mona Charon on yesterday's podcast. The spin from Hugh Hewitt, which is basically, this is just great, everyone. You know, ignore being wiped out in Virginia and losing the governor's race in Kentucky and what's happening in Pennsylvania. Republicans have to squeeze Donald Trump even tighter, which I suppose, you know, the nice way of describing that would be counterintuitive, right?
What, the mean way is delusional?
The mean way is delusional, which is the word I almost tweeted out about
this is the Trump world, right? Up is down and black is white. And at the end of the day, every path leads back to, if you just love Trump harder, everything will work out, regardless of how many data points we get to the contrary. And last night, you know, somebody pointed out that this was the third sort of election since Donald Trump has become president. And in every single one of them, Democrats have come out ahead. And, you know, last night's election was interesting for a whole bunch of reasons, both in Virginia and Kentucky. But Kentucky in particular, everybody is kind of trying to impose a lot of their, you know, feelings and worldview on. And it's a tough one because it's not Matt Bevin himself is a uniquely lousy character. Right. He's really unpopular.
He's really a dick.
I mean, it's
not just that ideologically he's like he just on every single level is kind of a repellent political figure, isn't he?
I heard a clip that I had not heard before of him talking about the teacher strike, and his line was, somewhere in this state, a child is being sexually molested because of this teacher strike. I can't imagine what kind of repellent figure thinks that is a good way to sort of handle the debate about a teacher strike. It's like essentially laying child molestation at their feet. And the thing is, though, that for Matt Bevin, hugging Trump tighter was the right call because he was so repellent and he was so unpopular in the state and a uniquely loathsome figure that he didn't have any choice. Right. His state went to Trump by 30 points. And so for him, it made sense to try really hard to nationalize the election and make it as much about Trump as possible, because Trump is popular. And so what we learned from it, though, because most of the other Republicans in the state did really well, is not that it was a repudiation of Trump in Kentucky. I think that's a real overread.
Right.
What it is, though, is that Trump just doesn't have the juice to pull absolutely anyone across
the line. The magic dust is not necessarily transferable to other
exactly.
folks. You know,
you can, even if you have a suit jacket with his face on it, as Bevin's had and is pictured in quite a bit, which is so weird.
We published that in Tim Miller's piece, the actual picture, because you actually have to see it to understand that this thing really exists and Matt Bevin actually wore it.
Yeah. And
remarkable.
It's first of all, it's fashion from just a pure fashion standpoint. It's a very ugly jacket. I don't know how often putting somebody's face on a jacket makes it more appealing, let alone Trump's face, let alone the whole thing is like blue patchwork. That's what he thought was going to help him. And the thing is, you know, he only lost by, I think it is like 4.4% at this point. In fact, I think I just saw before I came in here, he's asked for a re-canvassing in the state, which is essentially where they go back and check every single voting machine and every single vote to make sure that they were all tallied correctly. And I think it's just a matter of a few thousand votes. Now, that being said, re-canvassing has never actually resulted in the overturning of a result. So it's unlikely that it's going to change
anything.
It's
going to go through the motions, right?
That's right. But so even for somebody as deeply unpopular as him, you know, he got beaten by just a little bit. But the point is that, you know, Trump went out there, held a rally, you know, and tried to do the thing that that he's sort of become famous for, these politicians, that keeps them locked in, which is, if we can just stir up turnout, you know, you bring the celebrity in, that'll work. And it didn't this time. And I think that's really the powerful message, is that if you are, you think Trump's going to save you. And I think that's it's a lesson really for the guys that are in trouble in the swing states, you know, Cory Gardner or Joni Ernst, that he, you know, you really get in trouble. He just can't.
Yeah.
He might hurt you more than he's going to help you.
And the narrative out of Virginia and out of Pennsylvania is less ambiguous, I think, looking at the incredible turnaround that you've seen, particularly in the suburbs there. I can't get over the fact that just a few years ago, before Trump in Virginia, the House of Delegates was 66-34 Republican, and now it's going to have a strong Democratic majority. Nobody thought it was even at risk in the last off-year election, and now it is completely gone. But let's talk about the spin that you're getting from guys like Hugh Hewitt, that Republicans around the country really now need to read those results and cling tighter to all of it. And JVL, in his newsletter yesterday, had some great points about this. You know, the analysis from Hewitt in the past, you know, if it's not close, they can't cheat. You know, back in 2004, painting the map red, back in 2006 on the eve of that wipeout, the brief against Obama, why his presidency failed right before he was reelected. And he says that he mentions this not because he takes any pleasure in dunking on Hugh, but just as a reminder that he is not, in fact, a political professional whose livelihood depends on winning elections. He's a talk radio host whose livelihood depends on willingness to tell his audience what they want to hear. And, you know, as a former talk radio host myself, this is exactly right. And it's important to understand this mentality that the talk radio host, well, not every talk radio host, but of a certain breed, you know, really, you know, is there to be a safe space, is to rally the troops, is to outrage them, to reassure them. It's a completely different role than a pundit who steps back and says, okay, what did I actually see? What is the analysis? What hard truths do you need to know? And I think that there's a huge amount of that in the Republican Party. But the problem is that the more influential they are, the more delusional you're going to have folks on the right going into 2020.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I just think about somebody like you, and there's other people, you know, Michael Medved, like at some point you have to stretch too far, right? I mean, like it becomes too embarrassing, right? It's too embarrassing to sit there and say, I'm going to now tell you something where absolutely every data point I'm looking at tells us exactly the opposite, because you at some point have to maintain some shred of your credibility. At least I guess that's what I used to think. I mean, now you watch somebody like Rush Limbaugh, and I've never been a fan of, no offense, but conservative talk radio. But you look like somebody like Rush Limbaugh, who, you know, you just as by being sort of a right wing talker, has talked about the debt for decades as a main motivating tool for why we as Republicans should be in charge, because we're the sensible ones who are, you know, take the purse strings of the government seriously and won't be profligate, only to turn around, you know, in the last 8 months, I think he said, who cares about the debt? Why, this was always a scam. We never cared about this. And I guess it takes a certain kind of person
without any shame
that I just can't understand. Yeah, that just doesn't have any. Yeah, exactly. It's that absence of shame. And Hugh Hewitt, I guess Hugh Hewitt's tough. I mean, he's not an unserious person, or he didn't used to be an unserious person. And but now this is totally clownish.
Well, yeah, it is. And maybe we ought to rethink what we mean by being a serious person. Well, you know, the thing about Limbaugh, because I've thought about this a lot, he's been more naked in his, you know, his admission that it's really not about conservatism or conservative values, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm thinking back to years ago, I wrote a piece about him. Because I was always anxious when I was on the air to differentiate myself from Rush Limbaugh. And one of the things that I had picked out was his obsession with always saying that Republicans, and no, that particularly in conservatives, that conservatives were always winning. conservatives were always winning, liberals were always panicking. And if Republicans weren't winning, it's because they weren't conservative enough. But he was locked into all of this. And that became a problem back in 2006 when neither conservatives nor Republicans were winning. They were being blown out. And I wrote a piece called The End of Limbaughism, which was really just this sort of endless hacky triumphalism that that every data point shows that we are on top and the other side is losing. Not that we're right or they're wrong or that we're standing for something. We're just beating them. And the more I've thought about it lately, it says this was really proto-Trumpism, which is that we fight, we win, we're on top. There's no room for saying, you know, yeah, it's we got shellacked there. We need to rethink this. We need to engage in introspection. That is a completely alien concept in talk radio. And just one other point on this talk radio thing, because I am a little obsessed on this. There's and I'm not going to mention him because he's a good friend. And he's somebody that back in the day I would have loved for our station to have hired. Really smart guy, very, very knowledgeable about politics and policy, and was extremely anti-Trump throughout the campaign. And somebody sent me an email today showing me that he's speaking at some Republican event where he's going to have a talk on why Donald Trump is completely innocent and the impeachment process is utterly bogus. I think that's a pretty fair summary of it. And I'm thinking, how did this guy go from there to here? And also, why? You know, why not just stick with talking about conservative ideas or principles? Can't you do that without going totally into the funhouse mirror world of Trumpian defense? You know what I'm saying? It's like you can be talk about, you know, spend your time talking about Elizabeth Warren's Medicare for All or the latest outrage you got from the social justice warriors. It's this impulse that you have to now defend every bit of Donald Trump's conduct that just blows my mind.
Yeah, there's just too many incentives to do it, though. I mean, we wonder why people do it, but we kind of know, right? It's because there is an entire industry that is willing to reward those who will debase themselves at the feet of Trump, because there's a huge market for it. Now on the right, and there's a lot of us who had been unwilling to do it. And so for those who are still willing to go on Fox News or any other channel or on talk radio and defend the indefensible, you know, there's plenty of rewards in that. They act like the Never Trumpers. You know, that somehow there's like some great upside to being a Never Trumper. There's like fancy cocktail parties or something
No.
That's not the case, but there are very real incentives for being willing to defend Trump on all counts.
Although you would think the downside of looking foolish would weigh on people's minds.
Yeah, but who are they looking foolish to? What are us the elite, you know, media and these and terrible Never Trumpers? Who do they need to impress? I mean, you know, for me though, it has to come back to personal shame and a personal sense of integrity. But one of the things I always think about when I watch, you know, Lindsey Graham today say things like, you know, because he had said, look, if there was a quid pro quo, this was weeks ago, if there was a quid pro quo, I would find that very concerning.
Yeah.
But today his line is, look, these guys are so incompetent. How could they even come up with a quid pro quo? Their Ukraine strategy, you know, was a mess.
Yeah. Too dumb to collude. Too incompetent to engage in quid pro quo.
So it's crazy to watch these guys do this. And sometimes I wonder if it's my age, but I came of age, like I became politically aware around the Clinton impeachment trials. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these same guys were there. You know, it was Lindsey Graham. It was Mitch McConnell. And, you know, and I was sort of a, you know, budding conservative. And so you've got these two sides that I'm seeing as I encounter the parties really for the first time. And one of them, you know, is being led by this, you know, kind of dirtbag who's done this gross thing and then lied to the country about it. And on the other side, you got a bunch of people talking about the rule of law and the importance of these institutions and oversight and of telling the truth. And I was like, you know, I want to be on that side. And to watch them now, 20 years later, just the same people on impeachment. I mean, look at just to take another one, you know, if you were talking to Mona about this, Andy McCarthy.
Oh, yeah.
Who, you know, wrote a book about why Obama should be impeached.
And an article and why Hillary Clinton should be impeached even before she
took office.
Yeah. So.
And now they just like stretch our credulity so far with the idea, how could this possibly be impeachable? What what is the Constitution? It's not even constitutional to impeach somebody. I mean, smart people saying totally ridiculous things. I wonder if we'll ever get an answer as to really why, because even the incentives I mentioned, they don't feel big enough.
I was getting at. What the Lindsey Graham was extraordinary. I thought the other day that it was actually a tell. That you know, he had invested in the, well, there's no quid pro quo. Just look at the transcript, which, of course, is not a transcript. It's just a phone call. It's very obvious now that it's not just the phone call. It's a pattern of behavior that's extended over months and months and months. And almost every one of the professionals who had a firsthand view of that were alarmed by it, were concerned that it was illegal. And so it's becoming it had become less and less viable to make that, you know, that defense. And then it was completely destroyed when Sondland's testimony was, when he flipped on his testimony. And so there's Lindsey Graham, who's running on empty. He's got nothing. And so they ask him, well, Lindsey, you said that if there was evidence of quid pro quo, you'd find that concerning. And he's just like, no, it's I'm not even going to read it. It's all BS. I'm not going to read it at all. Which for the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee is amazing, because basically what he's saying is that he's taken the full, you know, cult 45 position that no evidence is going to change his mind. He's just bailing on it. It was an embarrassing moment. His argument that they're too incompetent to collude is in some ways his walk back from his I'm just going to put my head up my you know what. For a while, I'm not going to pay any attention. Oh, so one last comment on this, the sort of the denialism of the election. The numbers out of the Cincinnati suburbs and out of the Philadelphia suburbs are really stunning. And of course, in Northern Virginia, it's not just that Virginia has turned Democratic. It is the extent of it, but also how far down ballot it reaches. There are some counties that used to be reliably Republican where there's not a single Republican office holder, where Trump is nowhere near the ballot, and yet the Republican Party has been so toxified in these areas, they have been absolutely wiped out. And so we're sitting here right now looking at this spin from folks going, everything is fine, we need to double down, we need to do more of this, there's no adjustments to be made whatsoever. Okay, so I want to switch gears a little bit. Because I noticed that you have been in a little bit of a debate, and I find it to be an absolutely fascinating debate over the question of the swing state persuadable voters. I do think that New York Times survey, and I talked about this with Mona yesterday a little bit, the New York Times Siena survey showing how close those swing states were really was kind of a jolt to the system. And then the breakdown of who these persuadable voters were, and they look pretty familiar to, I think, you and I. But there are a lot of folks who are saying that, no, it really shouldn't matter who the Democrats nominate. That's not that important. I think this is an incredibly consequential debate, and I want to delve into it right after we hear a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by Simply Safe. A recent Gallup survey shows that Americans worry more about burglary than almost any other crime, more than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft and murder. And what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes have home security, maybe because most companies really don't make it that easy. And that's why Simply Safe is my top choice. Simply Safe protects your whole home, every window, room, and door, with 24/7 monitoring for just a fraction of the cost. Their police dispatch is up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. And it's really easy to order and easy to set up, usually in less than an hour. Simply Safe has won a ton of awards, from CNET to the New York Times Wire Cutter, and prices are always fair and honest. Around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. So visit simplysafe.com/bulwark. You'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure to go to simplysafe.com/bulwark so they know that our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/bulwark. Okay, we're back with Sarah Longwell, who is the publisher of The Bulwark. I think that this breakdown of the persuadable voters is fascinating, because there is this, I think, dangerous myth out there that I hear all the time, I will say, on a certain cable network, that there are no persuadable voters. There are no swing voters. They're just the hardcore deplorables. And then there are the idealistic progressives who are going to come out no matter what in huge numbers, and they're going to vote against Donald Trump. I think I think that's delusional. This race comes down to Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and you're looking at swing voters who tend to be, I would say, you know, center right, maybe center left. These are people who are looking for moderates. These are people who may have voted for Donald Trump, but are now looking for a reason to vote against him. And it matters tremendously who the Democrats nominate.
Tremendously. And I, the thing that I keep hearing from some of our friends on the left, and Will Wilkinson, who's a really smart guy, had tweeted something like this morning that was like, stop listening to all these people who are worried after that New York Times poll. Any of the top tier Democratic nominee or candidates can beat Donald Trump. Just don't worry about it. And I feel a lot of things when I hear this stuff. One is, it seems like people have not internalized the lesson of 2016, where everybody, you know, felt so good from the polling and, you know, was so certain. And I may have even said this on the podcast before, but I always want to ask people to remember how they felt at 9 a.m. On November 8th, 2016, and then to remember how they felt at 9 p.m. on that same day, when they watched everything fall apart, and just to remember that that can happen again.
Well,
and one of the reasons
it could, and I mentioned in my newsletter the other day, I had a preview copy of Rick Wilson's new book, which I hope every Democrat in the country reads, and he starts off that way. He starts off basically imagining election night 2020, where Democrats are, you know, prepared to, you know, eat their wine and cheese, and then suddenly the results come in, and they find out, whoa, they're losing again in Pennsylvania and in Michigan and Wisconsin. When it suddenly dawns on them that maybe voters in these states were not as woke as they thought they were. They weren't that interested in Medicare for all and abolishing private health insurance and confiscating guns and legalizing illegal immigration and all of those things. So he sort of starts off with that slap in the face, essentially making the same point you're making. Imagine if you get this right, what that's going to feel like next November.
Yeah, I mean, Democrats, they need to, you know, dance like nobody's watching and run like they're 10 points behind all the time. I thought that New York Times poll was really good and sobering for them to understand. And one of the things that I've done, you know, when you're somebody like you and I who's been a Republican all their life, and then 2016 happens, I felt very unmoored, because I felt like I didn't understand my own party, a party that would nominate Donald Trump, and then certainly sort of moderate voters would then go along and vote for him. I found that so shocking. And so I tried to make a study of what I call reluctant Trump voters. So people who didn't vote for him in the primary, which is most of the ultimately the Trump voters, and then people but who did vote for him in the general election. And I do focus groups in these key states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, all the time. And most specifically, I listen to groups of women, both college educated and non-college educated. And these are people who voted for Trump, but didn't love him. And I got to tell you, for them, who the Democrats nominate is 100% the key to who they
okay,
vote for.
Okay, so what do they tell you?
So you'll listen to them, and they will, the women especially, they loathe him. Mm-hmm. They think he's noxious. They think he is an egomaniac. They think he's a criminal. They think he's all these things. And I think that's what a lot of the people on the left hear. They know that people feel that way. And then I'll say to them, okay, how many of you will vote for Joe Biden? And, you know, half the hands will go up.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll say, okay, how many of you would vote for Elizabeth Warren? And like one person will kind of half put her hand up and say, like, I don't know. And you'll hear the same thing all the time. I think she's Hillary 2.0. I'm not making a value judgment on the fairness of that assessment, because I think there's a lot of things sort of tied up in that are not fair. She's actually not Hillary Clinton. To me, she's actually considerably, from a policy standpoint, worse. But these people And I'll also admit that, look, we're a year out. She could potentially rehabilitate her image with these people by, you know, bringing them over to her side, running the kind of campaign where she's clearly, you know, a lot of the Democrats have found her compelling. You know, is it impossible that she does that? It's not impossible. That being said, what they think about her, not just Hillary 2.0, but that she's extremely far left, which is a correct assessment of who Elizabeth Warren is. And they are afraid, both in terms of how the economy is doing, because it is still pretty good, and in terms of healthcare, they find her too scary, too far left, too radical. And to me, if you, at the end of the day, have people who hate Trump, don't want to vote for him again, and you can't convince them to vote for your candidate in these swing states, that is a huge problem.
This is exactly the kind of voter that I have in mind, that I'm thinking of, you know, particularly from the, you know, Milwaukee suburbs, who gets Donald Trump, who would not disagree with anything you and I said about Donald Trump, but they would think that Elizabeth Warren is the bridge too far. And for our center left listeners here, it's not just her personality, though that's not necessarily a plus. I mean, maybe that's a slight downside. It is the aggressiveness of the plans, and I think it's the arrogance of the plans, and the way that her how I will pay for Medicare for all played out, I think really I think it's going to hurt her short term and long term, because the numbers don't add up. They are just too huge. That when you're talking about increasing federal spending by basically the, well, 100% increase in federal spending, shifting this vast expenditure onto the backs of taxpayers, you don't need to be a policy wonk to realize that's a problem. Not to mention the fact that they go, well, wait, aren't you also going to give us free college? And what about an infrastructure program? And where's the money going to go for this? And then when people start thinking about the massive levels of cuts in defense spending, what it will mean for health care, the Republicans are fully capable of demagoguing her policies, you know, death panels and all of that stuff, but they don't need to, because quite frankly, she succeeded in doing something that you know, it's kind of impressive, which is she's united almost everyone that I know of, from center left to you know, to center right to far right, recognizing that she's going too far with all of this. This will bankrupt the country. It could wreck the healthcare plan. Her attitude towards business is so hostile, and I understand the argument that she's not a socialist, she wants to save capitalism, and I think that there are a lot of reforms that are necessary, but her sense of hostility to business and her willingness to have a plan to solve every problem reminds me why I'm a conservative. It reminds me of that moment where you realize, you know, nobody in government is smart enough to be able to plan something as complicated as the U.S. economy, and she doesn't have the necessary humility. So all of those things, I think, are easily communicated to voters, and I think that voters might say, can I put up with four more years of Donald Trump's obscenity, of his misogyny, of his racism, of all of that? And I'll be honest with you, I think a lot of them will say yes, because that doesn't affect me in the negative way that Elizabeth Warren's plans. I went on too long there, but do you understand? Do you take my point? I mean, I really see how this plays out, and it kind of blows my mind that the Democrats, well, maybe because they live in their bubble, do not understand how hostile this is going to appear to a lot of these swing voters.
I think that's right. And I'll say, though, it's not just Elizabeth Warren. She fared the worst in that poll. And it was interesting, because one of the things that I saw that sort of deeper in the article is that when they asked these voters, you know, which would you rather have, somebody who is considered more liberal or somebody who is considered more moderate, 74-24 they split for more moderate.
Well, that's the same as the New York Times survey. Almost the exact same numbers.
No. That's what I'm referring to. New York Times survey.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So I think. But what's interesting is that so there's this sort of interest in more moderate people, which I would, you know, it'd be great if any of them could give a look to a Michael Bennett or an Amy Klobuchar or even Pete Buttigieg. But
Steve Bullock.
Yeah, you know, there's moderate, right. But it's funny. I mean.
Is John Delaney still running? Did I miss that?
No, he's out.
Oh, is he?
Isn't he?
I don't know.
I haven't seen. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's out.
Okay. Because there was actually a bunch of them.
Yeah, there was a lot of moderates, and it was exciting sometimes when they would all get on stage for people like us, I think. But, you know, they were really only asking, and it was interesting that they didn't ask about Pete. But what's funny is a lot of the lower tier candidates that I find this with Republicans, at least, the lower tier candidates, they don't know who they are. Like, they really only know Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, and Bernie Sanders. But one of the things that was interesting about the New York Times poll was not, so Warren fared the worst, but they were all still within the margin of error. And so, you know, you still have Bernie Sanders, you know, did a little bit better than Warren, which is interesting because their policies are almost identical. So there, you know, there's probably something else a little bit at play, whether it's her personality or, you know, I think it's fair to say maybe there's some sexism, because I certainly don't think Bernie Sanders wins any likability contests. Maybe that's just me. But even Biden, who is winning, who is up in those states, it's only by a point or two. And so I thought, you know, it was a real warning about Warren, because she's the front runner now and she looks like a very possible eventual nominee. And I thought that was an important wake up call. But it was a wake up call overall for the Democrats that, like, this is not a lock. Even with impeachment. And that's one of the things I see. I mean, I was just doing one in central Pennsylvania, and I was talking to a group of men who Trump voters who rate his job, you know, rate the job that he's doing quite low. And so, you know, sort of probing why, and you hear all the normal stuff. He's immoral, you know, not a good guy. But man, you get them on Democrats and they really start to run. And the negative polarity, the extent to which they don't affirmatively like Trump, but they really hate the Democrats,
it's
astounding.
Okay, so what do they say about Democrats?
You know,
what is
I would
it they
say
don't
that,
like about yeah, them?
So the
oh, by the way, John Delaney is still in the race.
No, he's not.
He's not dead yet.
Oh wow!
And by
he's got my vote. Now that you know he's in there.
Marianne Williamson is also still in the race. Just
oh yeah. Okay, I'm glad I've almost forgotten about her.
Let's not bury John. He's actually done the Bulwark podcast. So give him
that's
kudos.
Great. That's great.
Okay. Okay. So what do they not like about Democrats? What do they tell you?
I would say the thing that has sunk in the most, in terms of the narrative that Republicans have been trying to push. Is this socialist element, right? Which is, I think, where the big differentiator comes from Biden versus a Warren or Sanders. And one of the reasons I'm so concerned about Elizabeth Warren being the nominee is that this idea that like all Democrats are socialists is just like an easy talking point that you hear from everybody who's a Republican. It just rolls off their tongues. Yeah. Well, the Dems have really gone crazy. You know, they're socialists. They think everything should be free. And, you know, Joe Biden, obviously, when he contrasts himself to people like Warren and Sanders, he makes himself look much more reasonable, even though his plans are still quite progressive and to the left of Barack Obama. They just don't sound absolutely fantastical the way theirs do. And so I think that helps him. But if one of the things that I always am surprised about is that there is a tremendous amount of messaging discipline right now coming from the White House. You haven't heard Trump call Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas mm-hmm. in a long, long time. And that's because if you're Donald Trump, who do you want to run against? We know for a fact he wants to run against Elizabeth Warren. He doesn't want to run against Joe Biden, which is why he literally, you know, extorted Ukraine to investigate him to try to take the wind out of Biden's sails. Because that is not who he wants to face.
And that's been in the news, yeah.
Yeah, that's you may have heard something about that thing.
Right.
But they know the socialist narrative really works with Republicans because it fits every sort of nightmarish, caricature and cartoon version of Democrats that they have. And like if you created that Aristotelian version of a, you know, crazy socialist Democrat. Like, it's basically Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. But the thing is that Trump doesn't really want to go against Sanders either, because the one thing that Sanders has is a similar type of appeal specifically to the Trump-Obama voters, specifically to some of those white working class economic anxiety voters.
Do you think that Bernie Sanders is a stronger candidate in general than Elizabeth Warren?
I do think he's marginally.
Interesting.
Yeah, I do.
Wow.
And I dislike him more than her.
That's
I dislike him considerably more than her. I think he is. I also think he's much less likely to win the nomination. Because I think Elizabeth Warren, it's funny to me because they're so similar on the policy side because she doesn't want there to be any daylight between her and Bernie. But the people who support them are quite different. Everyone I know, all of my sort of just like milquetoast liberal friends, NPR listening, New York Times reading liberals, love Elizabeth Warren. They don't think that she's like out in left field. And so I think that there's a lot of women who are supporting her, college educated women, which is why she's so dominant in Iowa. Iowa is a state that is very much sort of suited for, you know, college educated white people who are really attracted to Elizabeth Warren. But she makes a really lousy general election candidate because she's not going to be able to court either. You either have to be able to pick off the Obama-Trump voters, white working class voters, or you have to be able to rout them in the suburbs. And then you've also got to have like a big turnout from African-Americans and Hispanics. And I think she loses all three of those because she's such a Democratic sort of base choice.
Well, you know, because you're on Twitter a little bit, you know what the blowback you get from supporters of Warren or people who are Warren curious, that you know, when she proposes Medicare for All, that, well, you know, it's a terrible problem and we have to come up with a solution. And it's that sort of, if there's a problem, any solution must somehow be acceptable. And that's not the way I think a lot of these persuadable voters are going to think this through, because nobody, I think, is excited about the status quo. They don't love the status quo, but they fear change they don't understand more than the status quo. And I do get the sense that there are Democrats who understand that you can say healthcare needs to be reformed, but you don't need to spend $20 trillion in addition, you know, raise taxes by $20 trillion. You don't need to abolish private health insurance. All of these problems are real, but they can be addressed by something that will actually appeal to all of them. And this is, I think, sometimes sort of, as I said before, it sort of reminds me why I'm a conservative. It reminds me of the impulse that you often have on the progressive left, that if I mean well, that I want to be evaluated based on my intentions and my feelings rather than on the actual consequences of my policies. I mean, I actually became a conservative, you know, watching urban policy back in the 60s and 70s, where you realize that the intention may have been wonderful, but the consequences were absolutely devastating, you know, destroying families, destroying cities, you know, wasting massive amounts of money, having all sorts of unintended consequences. And yet you would challenge people on the left, and they would appeal to their idealism and what they were hoping would happen. Well, that's one of the reasons why you had the, you know, conservative resurgence. I'm getting a sense that that's coming back, that if you care about the planet, then somehow that's a justification for the massive economic dislocation of the Green New Deal. If you want to provide health insurance for more people, then let's, you know, double the entire national budget with Medicare for All and come up with all these unicorn math problems. So I do think that is a huge problem.
Yeah, I mean, her healthcare bill is the equivalent of Trump saying we're going to build a wall and Mexico's going to pay for it. Like it is just a massive virtue signal.
It is.
That has no basis in reality. And I think Elizabeth Warren has to be careful because, you know, if your brand is I'm the most honest, I'm the most sincere, I'm the one who's always the straight shooter and going to tell you this, and I'm going to fight for you. And what starts to materialize is actually a brand that is something closer to dishonesty, where there's a counter narrative of, well, you're promising us all of these things, but like you can't possibly deliver on it. Or, hey, you know, you used other people's identity and sort of victim status to propel yourself. Those things all start to kind of link together in people's minds. It's one thing if you're Donald Trump and you're a perpetual cad and it's sort of baked in that you're a despicable person. It's another thing if your brand is, you know, truth and apple pie, and actually you've got a bunch of both policies and then personal things that kind of lend itself to the fact that maybe you're not always being straightforward with people. That's a real problem. And it's one of the ways that I think that Bernie ends up being a slightly better candidate than she is, because he's at least been very honest the whole time about what a change this is going to be, and the fact that you will have to raise taxes on the middle classes and you can't just pay for this with billionaires. And that honesty, the plan is still garbage and still is a crazy thing for all of them, like a crazy hill for them to die on, because it's got like 13% approval from the American people. I mean, taking people's private health insurance, and this is one of the things about these swing voters, they will understand. They may not understand all the finer points of healthcare policy, neither do I, but they'll understand pretty clearly the notion of having their private health insurance, which they like. I mean, Elizabeth Warren can talk all she wants about how everyone hates their insurance company. That's not true. They actually have, you know, broadly, people like their health insurance. They want to keep it. That's why they were so mad at Barack Obama when he said if they liked it, they could keep it, when that turned out not to be true. I don't understand why they feel like they need to tether themselves to this incredibly unpopular idea. Well, yes, I do. I mean, it's called a Democratic primary, I guess.
I guess. Okay, let's talk about impeachment. We got the word yesterday that the public hearings are going to start tomorrow. I'm sorry, tomorrow. Next week. They're going to be starting next week. So we're moving into the televised phase of all of this. We have a pretty good indication of who the star witnesses are going to be. Ambassador William Taylor, I'm sorry, I should have them all in front of me. Masha Yovanovitch, maybe Sondland, Colonel Vinland, all of these guys, Ambassador Volker, who really are turning out to be very, very compelling in making the case that there was a quid pro quo, that there was extortion. How does this move the needle? I raise this because there was a lot of concern before this week's elections that backlash to impeachment was going to mobilize this massive turnout of Republican voters, and it does not seem to have happened. So that's got to have emboldened the Democrats short term. On the other hand, impeachment remains underwater in these swing states, but we haven't told the story yet. So do you anticipate any movement among the kind of people you've been talking to in these focus groups when they start to hear and see this testimony? Assuming they will.
Yeah, I think, look, for everything that I have seen indicates it's sort of a good news, bad news for Trump, which is the bad news is, the good news is men are basically going to stick with him no matter what. Like, their position on impeachment is the Dems were going to get him one way or another. Everything this guy does, you know, all politicians do this. And this is I hear this all the time. All politicians do this. All politicians are crooked. He just says the quiet part out loud. And they always wanted to get him. That's kind of where the men are. And so I actually don't know or think that, you know, a bunch of people they know he did this thing. And that's why Republicans are going to sort of shift their talking points to, yes, he did it. It's not impeachable. It's bad, but not impeachable. The women are already there. Like, that's the bad news for him, that the women are like, yeah, he should be impeached. He clearly, you know, does all these things. And for them, I think it really becomes just a question of who the Democrats nominate or whether or not the Democrats comport themselves. Like, when I watched these public hearings, and I do think and worry about the backlash, because right now the Democrats have been sort of, if we're just sort of rank punditry, they've been winning the impeachment war in terms of the narrative. And the polling has been absolutely going against Trump, and independents and a small but not insignificant percentage of Republicans are now for impeachment and removal. Mm. And so what they want is they want that number to go from 51 to 59. And so if they're going to pick up, you know, 8 points or break into the 60s, they got to pick up more independent voters and some and peel away some sort of more of these Republican women, both college educated and not college educated. And so I think that all of this is now out there. So the question is like, will there be something explosive in the way that this gets communicated? That will be kind of a game changer. Is there anything that's going to come out that we don't know about already? Which there could be. Maybe Bolton testifies, and that's a game changer. Or you could have somebody like Schiff overreach. You could have the Democrats grandstand too much. They could look like, you know, they're going overboard in some way, and people could sour on it. And so, you know, I think that Democrats need to be very careful to be as by the book and as sober and as serious as possible throughout this process. Once the, you know, now that the cameras are being turned on, and make sure that it doesn't look like they are, that it's not a partisan witch hunt.
And just a reminder for folks who don't remember what happens when you have a Senate trial of impeachment, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presides over that. I mean, that's still a remarkable thing. I heard that again, and I knew that. And I'm thinking, you know, that reduces the possibility that the Senate trial will be a circus rather dramatically. I mean, Justice Roberts is not Lance Ito. He's going to keep control of all of this. And I think that there was some speculation that Senate Republicans might want the Bidens to, you know, drag the Bidens in to testify at all of this. And I'm sure that would be the impulse of the Lindsey Grahams. But I wonder whether or not calmer heads will prevail. But to going back to one of the key takeaways from listening to you describing the focus groups, there are people who right now would favor the impeachment and the removal of Donald Trump from the presidency, but who may yet vote for his reelection next November. Those people exist, right?
Yes.
Wow. That is a remarkable political reality that I think people haven't fully taken on board yet. Sarah Longwell, thank you so much for coming in and spending so much time with us. By the way, what about the rumors that there's going to be more Bulwark merchandise available?
I don't know, Charlie. I think it is time for Bulwark more merch.
Yeah.
I mean, you've been
human scum.
The podcast is doing almost 1 million downloads a month now. You know, we've got an incredible base that reads it every day. Our numbers are incredibly strong, and we're really appreciative how everybody sort of picked up and engaged with this project. But I feel like, you know, this Ahoy pirate ship over here, we should have some human scum merch and some other stuff.
Well, you notice I put on our Slack site all of the human scum, I am proud to be human scum t-shirts that are already out there. You know,
yeah, but we should do it in Bulwark.
Well,
we
exactly,
should do it with our, you know.
Exactly. So there's clearly a market. I don't know whether there's going to be, you know, proud to be human scum hats or mugs, but I'm in. I just
make America scummy again.
Oh man, I want that. Well, look, it's Christmas time is coming up. I'm starting to make lists. He lied because he never does this early. But you know, this would be the perfect gift, right? I mean, I have all kinds of relatives that, you know, I don't want to actually go out and shop for.
For the never Trumper in your life,
for the never Trumper in your life. Look, on Christmas morning, who is going to be disappointed to get a pair of I Am Human Scum slippers? Really, right?
I mean, it didn't even occur to me about slippers. Of course, I want those.
Well, I want the T-shirt. I don't know whether I need. I would settle for a T-shirt. Don't need the sweatshirt necessarily. Hoodie might be going too far. Do not want the I Am Human Scum with the hoodie. That doesn't work for me. But the mugs, let's see, mugs, T-shirts, what else?
Well, we could get those, you know, take a page from Matt Bevin's book. I'm going to get you a Trump face coat.
No, I want to pass on that. I just don't think it works. Okay, Sarah, so have a great weekend. Great talking with you. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.